Christian Dior poster girl, Moroccan Tim's chick and the Gucci loafer girl. When they say I'm too pretty, this bit rhymes is gritty. What y'all thought? I'd be dancing around in suits like I'm pretty. Let them know how we run this city. Respect my name. Boogie, stay in your lane like the hurricane. Rains on snitches like Sugar Shane. And dear, when of y'all rapping chicks to mention Fox name. What's beef? Beef is when y'all broad thinking sweet. See, I'm frontin' in the streets and let my leak. Sometimes I feel like I'm just too real. I love to stack riches. No disrespect, y'all. I respect the rap game, but I don't roll with rap lames. I'm speaking from my heart. It's not that I'm too good, I'm just hood. Been like this since a young broad. Remember when I bust my girl in 96? Y'all ain't never seen me flick up with them fake chicks. See this smile up in your face? Turn around and pop slick. You an industry chick, I'm an in the streets chick. I might breeze through Chloe, Fendi or Tips, but other than that, it's just me and my six kids.
Welcome to the Those African Chicks podcast, where a platform that encourages African women to be their most authentic selves and fearlessly live out their truths. We cover everything from creativity to business to parenting and just personal evolution. We're your hosts, Rumi from Nigeria and Chesri from South Africa. Welcome.
Are we on? Are we live?
We're live.
Okay, we are live and I am so excited to be talking about this. Wumi is rolling her eyes and she doesn't want to talk about this, but I think it's an important topic. We're talking about body image and loving yourself.
Hi guys. The Nigerian.
The South African.
Hi.
Why the sigh?
So Chesri has a knack of making you talk about stuff that you're not ready to talk about. This is her virtue and her vice. Literally, there are times when I'm like, oh, I'm meeting up with Chesri. Oh, God, this is going to be like a therapist session. She asked this question. She's like, so why? How does that make you feel? How does that, you know, she wanted to talk about body image and, oh, let's just talk about this thing and be done with it.
Okay. So why the hesitation?
It's just it's one of those things that I feel like I have to kind of be mentally ready for.
Why?
Not because I don't have body image issues? No, I don't think I do.
Okay.
But I always want to be on the slimmer side and I'm always wanting, I always feel like I need to be thinner.
Yeah.
I don't know if that means that I have some version of a body image issue.
I mean, I think we have this continuous struggle about looking and feeling good. And sometimes we equate our weight and what the scale says to the amount, to how we feel about ourselves.
Right.
And my goal in my 30s was that I don't want my scale to dictate how I feel about myself. And so it was really interesting when we went to Miami. I was like, oh man, I have to be in a costume, you know, in front of these people. And I'm obviously like, I've gained weight. I'm like, I'm bigger now than I was before I was pregnant. And when I got there and I was in my bikini or whatever, I was like, fuck it. I want to have fun. And I want to be out in the sun and I want my thighs to get sun. I'm not going to hide behind like scarves and long pants and, you know, things like that. I want to just be me and I want to be free. But body image is hard. I feel like even now after having a baby, it's like hard for me like to look at myself in the morning to feel like, wow, Chesri, like, you are like hot. You are so beautiful. Like it's really hard for me to feel like that every single day. There's days when I feel like that, but there's days when I don't.
But that's just also the cycle of things, right? Because even if you're thinner, you're never thin enough.
That's the thing. It's like chasing this like
this shining object that you can't, that you can never reach.
It keeps moving. It keeps moving. It keeps moving. Now, when I look at myself and look at my pictures in my 20s, and I think to myself, I was fine. I was absolutely fine. I wasn't a big, like, big girl, like, you know, huge. And I look back at those pictures and I'm like, oh man, even if I could just look back like that again now, I'd be fine.
And that's always the thing, is that when you're even at your thinnest, you always want to be thinner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always been, I find that that's always been my struggle. You know, I remember being 128 pounds and I was like, oh, now the goal is 120.
Mm.
It was just never enough. And then I ballooned up to 197 at pregnancy. Yeah. The day I had both of my, well, at when I had AJ, I was 197. When I had Emma, I was 195.
Mm-hmm.
And after having baby and all that stuff, you know, then you're like, I would settle for 135.
Yeah.
You know, and even now, I did this whole Master Cleanse thing a week ago. And at the time I started, I was 154.
Wow.
Somewhere around there.
Which is still, like, an amazing weight for a mommy. Like, you look super good in Miami.
Yeah, well, thank you. But, you know,
and now you're even smaller now than you were in Miami.
So now, you know, what the Master Cleanse does is, you know, if anybody knows about that, you know, you're just drinking this lemonade thing, you know, and you're literally detoxifying your body.
Mm.
The byproduct of that is that you lose weight. It's not supposed to be a weight loss tool, but people like me use it to lose weight.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
But I wanted a quick fix. And that gave it to me.
Mm.
And by the time I ended the Master Cleanse, I was 144, mm-hmm. 142, swinging between 144 and 142. And I wanted to go further because I wanted to be smaller. And I had to catch myself and just be like, okay, stop. Because then it's like that rat race, right?
Yeah.
Because now I'm, you know, when I was 154, 144, or one even 145 was the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And I've surpassed that goal, but now it's not enough. I want to be 135. And I had to just be like, you know, stop talking about it because I have a daughter that's 4 years old.
And she's watching.
And what is she internalizing
by
my behavior? By just watching my behavior and watching the things that I'm saying. So I had to just make myself stop and be like, stay in the 140s and enjoy it and get to a healthy mental state about the 140s
mm-hmm.
before I venture into the 130s.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, you know, it's almost like this slippery slope
mm-hmm.
where you almost like develop some sort of like a body image issue without realizing that you have one.
Yeah.
And I guess
what was the urgency? Tell me about. I mean, you look amazing. You've lost a lot of weight.
Thank you.
And I'm sure a lot of mothers want to know about it. But I also want to preface it by saying that there is really no quick fixes. This is like we try to achieve changing our lifestyles. Is that wrong?
Yeah, no, you are right. There's no quick fix. And the Master Cleanse, I've done this so many different cycles.
I know you did it in grad school.
Yeah, I mean, I've done it so many times. Mm-hmm. Grad school was the first time I did it.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the biggest problem was that I just, you know how you just have those days where you just don't feel good about, you don't feel pretty. I'm going through postpartum shedding. So I'm losing some hair on the side of my head. I don't feel attractive. The other part of it is I have a lot of clothes, and I have, even I must say for myself, I collect beautiful clothes.
You do have beautiful clothes.
And it sucks not to be able to fit in anyone.
That's the part for me about postpartum that was hard, is getting into that dress that you know used to fit you, and now you can't even pull the zip up.
Exactly.
And it is like literally like soul wrenching. It's just like, oh man, oh. You know, it's hard. And then you go to the second dress and that one doesn't fit either. So now you're like, oh, two of my stuff doesn't fit me. That's two less things I have to wear.
Yeah.
And what I've done over the last weeks, I told you about this, is that I have tried to...
Sorry, that's me. That's my mother FaceTiming me. I did turn everything down, so sorry about that.
So what was I going to say, Wumi?
You were saying that it's soul-wrenching.
I actually lost my train of thought now.
The trying on one outfit, it doesn't fit, and then you move to the next one, and then...
Oh, yeah, actually, yeah. That I'm trying a thing where I have 30 pieces of clothing on my styling rack, or on my... I have, like, the silver clothing rack, you know, mm-hmm. like the designers use, or like modeling houses use. And the goal is, and it's a line called like 30, it's like 30, it's like 333. And they try to have 30 pieces on your rack for 3 months at a time, because that's how long a season is. And it's a very minimalistic approach to your clothes.
I love that. Who, what?
It's on Pinterest.
I have to write that down. What's it called?
I think it's 333. But it's like a minimalistic wardrobe, and you can actually Google minimalistic wardrobe.
I'll put that on our Facebook
handle. Yeah. And it's a very interesting way of looking at your it's called 333 wardrobe. Project 333. That's what it's called, Project 333.
Okay.
And so so what I'm doing now is I'm only putting, my goal is for, you know, is to now only put pieces on that rack that I love to wear. So when I put it on, it's fabulous, it's seamless, it's easy to wear, and it's stuff that you can mix and match. So there's a lot of girls now on YouTube who are putting their own wardrobes online and showing, because every girl puts it together in different ways.
Right.
Some girls that like jeans more would have like 4 jeans, 2 skirts, 4 dresses, and then blazers that they can mix and match with all of it. And I'm trying to do that with mine as well now.
I love that idea, just simply because it also forces you to kind of wear what you have.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I tried to do that earlier on this year when I was going through like this whole detoxing of my closet, because I was reading this book on living a minimalist lifestyle, and I was like, yeah, why am I collecting all these clothes? Because I go through like these almost like shopping attacks where,
really?
maybe not attacks is a strong word, but during Zara sales, I literally know when the day their sales go on.
Are you serious?
And I stock like particular pieces, and I buy these things. Like, I'll go to the Zara in Greenwich where I work, around where I work. If they don't have something, then I'll go to Fifth Avenue, then I'll go to Yonkers. And it's this mad obsession to buy a particular outfit or a particular shoe. But then I find that once I buy it, then it's just sitting in my closet. I forget that I have it. Can you believe that?
Are you serious?
I literally forget that I have it.
So right now you have Zara items in your closet that you're not even wearing.
I have clothes that have tags on them. And I was like, why am I investing in clothes? You know, yesterday I went out and I found this yellow blazer that I literally went to like 5 H&Ms before I found the perfect size. Because it was like me, I wore the medium, one place had the large didn't quite fit, then I returned the large, and then the medium was sold out, and then I went to different H&Ms in different places until I found it. And then I bought that blazer, and this was like 3 years ago, and I finally just wore it in 2016.
Can you imagine that?
And I didn't even realize the tag was still on until Emma was like, Mommy, can I have your tag? Because she likes to collect tags. And I was like, oh, the tag is still on. I spent $49 on that blazer.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
But wait, woman, let me ask you this. What is the connection, do you think, between the clothes that we wear and our body image?
For me, clothes make me feel good. I love to... And this is not feeling good for my husband or any of that. It makes me... I like the way I feel when I dress a certain way, and I find that I don't have a particular style. I swing between being, not hippie, but like being like that relaxed, throw on a jeans, wear a hat kind of chick, to being like the glamour girl. And even the glamour girl, I find that I'm not very fascinated by her, but I can be her depending on if I need to. And I can channel that girl very easily. Especially when I have a weave. My Nigerian girls know about the glamour girl. More than half of the Nigerian girls are glamour girls. So for me, going back to body image and clothes, I like to be able to channel whatever girl that I want to be like when I want to.
Yeah.
And being a particular size allows me to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to, like, all the clothes that I have, I just wanted to purge.
Mm-hmm.
And I have I have so many clothes that it was just cheaper for me to lose weight than to start buying a whole new wardrobe.
Yeah.
I
mean, so because my question is, well, I'm thinking about my own life and how I feel about myself. I tried the Master Cleanse, I think, once in undergraduate, and I failed. I think I did it for one day. And I bought... And I bought all of those. It's involved. You need to buy cayenne pepper and you need to have what do you call it? That brown syrup.
Grade B maple syrup.
You need good maple syrup and you need lemons. You need a ton of lemons. And I was very involved and I did it and I was going to do it with my two African girlfriends.
And which one of them? How? Dede?
No. It was while I was at Bard.
Oh, okay.
So I was there with a girl from Rwanda and a girl from Uganda. The Rwandese girl, she just killed it. She did it for almost like 6 days. But the first day, I was like done. I was like, this is just not for me. I just couldn't do it. And I think someone like Wumi can go on a cleanse and just do it. I cannot do it. It's just not the way I lose weight. But I do like... I started juicing and I think I'm slowly introducing healthy foods into my life. And the next level for me is now bringing yoga back because I love to do yoga.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and so I think I'm going to lose my weight very slowly. I think, and I'm trying to make peace with it. That's why I'm having clothes on my rack that only fit me because I don't want to go through this trauma every time I have to put on something nice.
Yeah.
And then there's girls like Wumi that can just put their mind on it and just so incredibly like laser focused. They can just say, you know, I want to drop... How much weight did you drop? Like 10 pounds? In like... 10 pounds. In like how many days?
12.
In 12 days?
Yeah, I did it for 12. I lied to you and said 10 just because I didn't want you to think I was crazy. Yeah, it was
12 days. It's going to even make you look more crazy.
I find that when I tell people about... I try not to tell people about the Master Cleanse just because I almost feel like a silent judge. Like, You know, like, I, and it's probably all me, but I feel like I can sense something else.
Yeah.
So I try not to tell people that I'm doing the Master Cleanse.
The thing is, you're feeling is that it's jealousy, because I think, even me, I'm like, why can't I be like that? Why can't I just focus on it and just get it done? It would make my whole life easier.
But it's mental prep, though.
It's mental prep, but there's something, I think, in just the way that you, who you are, that makes it possible for you. And I'm just not wired in that way where I can just do a master cleanse for 10 days. I did do a detoxifying cleanse for 7 days with Noah upstate. And it was awesome. It was really hard because you really didn't have a lot of energy. You were just detoxifying. That's the thing about it. And I'm still at work and I'm running around. And so I don't think I'll be able to do it, but I'm very, very impressed by it. But I'm chasing that feeling of I'm fierce and I'm beautiful the way I am.
And that's all that matters. And that's all that matters. Because speaking from somebody who's chased the shiny object of the skinny girl with the Master Cleanse, it's never enough. And at some point, you just have to kind of stop yourself and ask and find you're happy within all of that.
But what prevents us from just accepting ourselves the way we are? We can love ourselves and accept ourselves and still try to lose the weight.
It's that internalized, it's that internalized pressure of media, and social media does not help. Because everywhere right now, everyone's promoting bikini season, right?
Everybody's no, there's two pieces in every freaking store.
Every store you go to,
so upsetting.
Well, you can even avoid the stores, but if you have social media presence, or you participate in social media, everybody's already talking about it's about the beach and the swim, the pools, and everyone's like, you know, everybody's showing their badass six pack, and on some level, as much as you try to remove yourself from that, if you do participate in social media, you're ingesting and internalizing that information on some level.
You don't even
and
have to changing. Be on social media. You can just be in the world.
Well, that's true too. Yes. Yeah. You know, and it's on some level changing your thought process in a very slow and gradual way that you don't know.
Mm.
And you have to be very, very self-aware and self-conscious to be able to stop, to realize what is you and what is not.
Yeah. That's why I love the ebony cover. That's why I loved it.
With Chrisette Michelle, right?
Yes,
and now Gabby Fresh.
And Gabby Fresh. And I follow her on Instagram as well. Because I'm so inspired by them, Wumi. I'm so inspired by them. They look amazing. They look fierce. And they look happy. And maybe I'm idolizing what I'm seeing on the cover. But for me to see girls, you know, curvy girls on the cover, it's just affirming to me. Because we cannot all fit into this little skinny girl
size zero. And you know there's now negative zero.
Oh, please don't even say those things here. Don't even say.
It's like the
Satan is a liar.
There's
no truth in him.
There's size disappear and there's size you don't exist. I mean, what the hell is negative zero? But anyway, speaking of beautiful, big, curvy women, one of the things that I started doing, or even before I got pregnant, was I started following big girls.
Yeah.
Big girls with style.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to kind of force myself to ingest a different kind of beauty.
I do the same
thing.
And that's
why people like Gabby
same
Fresh,
thing.
Nadia Absalom.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, my God.
She's
Nadia,
killing it.
And I look at Nadia and I just, she, you know, she is, apart from the fact that she's a beautiful girl that's fierce, she just, she's like, yeah, I'm...
Did you see some of her talk videos?
She's like, I'm not a size zero, but guess
I'm
what?
A bad
I'm going to rock this crop top, and it's going to look good. And she makes it look good.
How does she do it?
I don't know. Her, and then the other girl that I really love is Girl with Curves.
Yeah, I follow her too.
She
has a fashion blog as well.
Yeah, yeah. She's had a fashion blog before Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And then one thing I love the most about her was, so she got married and had her son. And I was usually, what these girls do is that they have their baby and then they use their postpartum weight loss to kind of fit into the mold of like the size 4 girl. And she didn't do that at all.
She didn't.
And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
You know, but of course, every now and again, you slip back into your conditioned weight.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you go back to...
And she got back onto her fashion blog right after her birth. And
yeah.
She was like styling, looking sharp. And I'm like, for me, when I look at her specifically, like, I feel like, because she's had a kid and I know, you know, she's a mom. So I'm looking at her and I'm like, you know what? It's, you can see her brand. You can see her style. Even after she had a kid and she's not a small girl, but she is so on point and she's flawless. Like, she's flawless.
Yeah.
She's beautiful. And that's who I want to be, you know? And can you imagine woman? I'm imagining myself, right? I'm imagining that this is the kind of woman who is so okay with who they are that they just decide, I'm going to rock with it. I'm going to rock it and I'm going to drive this until the wheels come off.
And I think that's how it should be.
That's how it should
be. It's just that you have to just... there's a constant reminder that has to happen, right?
Yeah.
To be able to make sure that you make good on that promise to yourself,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's where we fail.
That's right.
Or that's where the challenge is,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But we should post all of the people that we follow that are curvy girls that we think
yes.
Is good on our Instagram account or wherever on
yeah,
Facebook.
We should do it on all the social media
yeah,
platforms.
Yeah.
You know?
Just to give links to people that we think you know, are inspiring. I also follow this other curvy girl on Instagram, Miss... I'm going to say her name wrong. Like Tootle, it's like a French name. But she only models... in lingerie that she designs.
Oh, really? That's
yeah.
Cool. I've definitely.
I'm gonna find her name. It's like Miss Tourelige or something like that.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Like French. And I'm inspired by her because she's curvy, she's gorgeous, and she designs lingerie for girls that have curves. And you know, for me, it's always been a struggle to find like things like I have big boobs. I'm what like a H cup or something, a I or D or whatever. And I can't find like nice colors. And so it's nice to see girls that are like, I would have a pink bra, I would have a red one and, you know, lace and that kind of thing. And when you have big boobs, it's just almost impossible to find it, you know?
Right, it seems to be more functional, created to be more functional
what?
Than sexy.
Beige. Yeah. Beige is like the basic color.
And it's not beige for black people, right?
No,
it's like that tannish thing
it's
that
like
it's not for...
Literally, they should call that color
nude.
No sex in 10 years. That's what they should call that kind of color bra because your ass is not having sex if you're wearing that kind of bra. It can't happen. It's just not sexy. But let's hit something... So how do you want Emma to feel about her body?
Oh my
like
gosh.
Raising a daughter.
I
think about it all the time with her mama.
This is the thing with Cesar always goes to, like the personal stuff. She's like, yeah, we talked about the flop. Let's get to personal. With
what,
Emma,
what are we going to talk about our daughters?
I you know, every day that I'm constantly thinking about the kind of young woman I want Emma to grow up to be.
Explain that young woman.
And as much as I think about who that woman is, I'm trying to also remember what is my fantasy and what is the person that she is. And I'm trying to make sure that I'm conscious that they don't mix with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can fantasize of who I want her to be all I want. I want to make sure that I'm the parent that allows my daughter to be who she is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard because I'm constantly slipping into what I know, which is what I was raised by. So it's, you know, this is what you do because this is what we do, as opposed to this is what you're doing because this is what you feel is right for you. So my fantasy of Emma is that she's not the kid who worries about all this superficial stuff. She will worry about these things because she's a woman, and she just lives in the world that we live in. And if the world does not change, some of these concerns are things that she would be concerned by. I just want her to be the young woman that's not overly concerned about those things.
Which
that
does not her self-esteem.
Exactly. Or affecting her identity, you know. I don't want her... I want her to see color, but not see color.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is I want her to be able to understand that she is a black woman and be proud of the fact that she's a black woman and she's a... I'm proud of her. She's a black woman and she's a black African woman.
Yes.
And be proud of what that means.
Yeah.
But I don't want her to see color in the sense that I don't want her awareness of blackness and Africanness to affect her having genuine and authentic relationship with people.
Yeah.
I want her to have a very diverse
group of friends
that enrich her.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to have thought-provoking conversations that, you know, that lead to things that that make change. And then in terms of beauty, I don't want her to be overly concerned with like what the commercial standards of beauty are and be drawn to people because they look a certain way. Even if it's that she's drawn to them because, you know, the girl with the afro, the cool afro chick who's just like, flipping the bird to the system is kind of the trend right now. Asian chicks are all they're all rocking afros, and white chicks have like braids and dreads these days. You know, I don't want her to be guided by those things. You know, even if it's pro black, I don't want her to be attracted to somebody because of that. I want her to be more focused on who they are and the content of their behavior rather than what they're projecting.
I feel like I read this somewhere that the daughters when they look at their mothers, they learn by what they see and not by what they hear.
I can see how that works. Speaking of body image and beauty standards, I wear makeup.
Me too. I love concealer.
You know, and I like makeup, and I've been rocking the dark lip thing. You know, I have like the brown, and I have all these like dark lip colors.
And you're rocking it too.
Excuse me. And of course, my daughter's in the bathroom with me, and she's like, I want makeup, you know, and I'm like, no. And you know, at first it was fun, and I would put a little blusher in her and bronzer in her, but then she's been consuming all this YouTube Kids where... you have kids online who are wearing makeup.
Can you
imagine? I guess maybe the makeup threshold has changed in this world. I mean, in the age that we're in.
Because younger kids are wearing makeup now.
But I find my daughter constantly asking me for makeup and telling me that it's not fair when I tell her not to. So I've completely stopped even putting it on her Facebook Play because I don't want that to snowball into something. And then she says things like, oh, you look so pretty with your makeup. And I'm like, yeah, but I also look pretty without makeup. And I'm trying to reinforce the notion that you do not need something external to be beautiful.
But you know what is hard? Like, I feel like it sucks because I never used to wear makeup. You know, in grad school, I never used to wear makeup. And I think I started using makeup when I maybe turned like 27, 28. And now for me, it's like, I love by like basics like concealer, and you have to have good mascara. And then one day I decided, you know what, I'm not going to, I invited a colleague of mine over, and I decided, you know, I'm not going to wear makeup. I'm in my house. I'm chilling. I'm not going to do anything. And she came in, and she was like, wow. She was like, oh, wow, you're not wearing any makeup. You look very different. And it really hurt my feelings.
You're like,
I was like, what do you mean? I look different. Can you elaborate? But I was too embarrassed and hurt by it. So I was like, I didn't even want to like address like why she's saying it. And then it started making me feel like maybe I do look more beautiful with makeup. But then I was like, Chesley, you know that's not true. You know that this is not your politic. It's not your value. You know that you wear it because it's something that is just, it adds. It's just, it has to add. It can't be what makes you beautiful. But it's definitely hard because I do feel like now that I'm in my 30s, my early 30s, I'm like, maybe I've become a little bit too dependent on makeup. Like, when I go to work, I wear makeup. You will not find me at work without makeup.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
On the weekends, I don't wear makeup when I'm like, going out for shopping and that kind of thing. But if I'm in the mornings, it's part of my routine. I get dressed and I wear makeup.
Let me, I have a similar experience. So, for me, it all depends on time. If I wake up early, I wear makeup. If I don't, well, I'm going to work barefaced. And I remember somebody at work, I'm not going to say who, but somebody at work looked at me, saw me one day, and she said, are you okay? It was one of the days that I didn't have time to wear makeup. So I just, you know, I didn't even have like a finishing, my shine was still on because I put on this vitamin C serum oil thing. Mm. And she was like, are you okay? She looked at me all concerned. I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. Why? She was like, you look like you're sad. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not sad. So I'm like... She said, oh, okay, and just, you know, and then she was still hovering. I'm like, you know, so now I'm like getting irritated. And she's like, okay, she just wanted to know because she just wanted to make sure that I'm doing okay. I'm like, I'm not wearing makeup, you know, so if that's what you're trying to say, say it. I'm not wearing any makeup.
Is that, but do you think that's what she meant?
Of course. But, you know, it's that talking around the point.
Because you were feeling fine.
I felt fine, and I knew exactly, you know, immediately she said, are you tired? I'm like, this bitch is going to tell me, that it's, you know, I already knew what she was doing, but I wanted to make her say it. So I said no.
Bitch, no, I'm not sad. I'm glad.
But you know, see, the same thing, how people are trying to say, oh, you should wear makeup, or almost like make you feel that you need to wear makeup. So after that day, I decided that I will routinely go to work without makeup. Get used to this face. Now, the day that you see me wear makeup, you know, take me as I am. But it's not it's not part of the job requirement for me to wear makeup on, put makeup on. And I'm not going to put on makeup because it makes you feel better.
And then the thing that makes it worse is now I come home, I'm exhausted, I have a child, I have my husband, I don't even have the energy to take the makeup
to wipe it off.
Now I go sleep with the makeup. Now, in a couple of weeks, now I have skin problems. You know what I mean? Or my skin looks older. That's part of why I'm starting to juice also. Just clean
Claire,
my
your
skin.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like these dark circles are more obvious now because I have a baby and she's up at night sometimes. It's the struggle is real.
Yeah,
basically.
Me too. I have the same thing with the dark circles, and you know, but this is I guess we kind of moved into beauty, and I guess it is, you know,
yeah,
body
exactly.
Image, beauty, it's all the same, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think I like what you said, you mix going to work with wearing makeup without wearing makeup, and maybe I should challenge myself and do that. For me, it's just like I'm now, because of like I think that moment, I'm just now like a little insecure about.
And you're also now, you're a director now, so I guess that also comes with some unspoken rules, right?
I feel so, but I also told you, like, you know, I feel like I work with people that dress really well to work.
So there is, you see, that's the wonderful thing with working with kind of people that I work. I can schlep to work. Now, if I worked in an office filled with black people, you know that I have to dress up all the time.
and the thing about it is that I think some of them just make it look like it's easy.
Yeah, that's that. I don't know how people, that effortless.
Effortless. Some girls just have it down. And I think, yeah. If there's a blog that I would want to read from and learn from, it would be a blog called How to Have an Effortless Wardrobe. I don't have it. I don't know if it exists, but that's something that would help me in my life.
I'm sure they're out there.
Yeah. So that's us. That's our body image. I think we're trying to... let me speak for me. I'm trying to find myself, but I make a vow to myself that I would try at least every day to love myself the way I am. That I'm not perfect, but... In my imperfections, I'm still Cesare, and I want to be loved the way I am, and I want to be happy the way I am without it being dependent on the scale. And so it's an everyday commitment and taking a day at a time. I think that's my wrap up and wrap around.
Yeah, mine's not as eloquent and poetic as Cesare's. Mine is just I need to work out more. I find that.
Oh my god, that's good. You guys see you with me.
No, I mean, like, dude, we're being real here. Mine is, I find that I'm happiest when I run. I used to run, you know.
You used to run.
You know, races.
Running is not my thing. Yoga's my thing, but running is your thing.
Yeah, you know, and I find that for me, that works. You know, I like that feeling of running. I literally feel like I'm leaving all of my problems behind. There's just something very
freeing. You're running away from your problems.
I'm running away from my problems, right? There's something very freeing for me about running, and I'm able to go into this kind of weird state of mind, and I cannot explain it, but it's almost like I'm in my body, but I'm not there. And I know people, especially, you know, the Africans would be like, you know? But I can't explain it, but I'm just able to almost like check into a different part of me. Mm-hmm. And I like that feeling. So my goal, buddy image, is to stop looking for quick fixes and be more fitness oriented, since that seems to be what works.
Mm-hmm.
And also just, you know, eat more greens and do all that that people tell you to do. Eat and have a more healthier lifestyle and be green and eat more vegetables, blah, 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 blah. That stuff. Yeah.
I know, right? We're so enthusiastic about healthy lifestyle. That's why we have this podcast. Anyway.
All right. Let us know what your body image issues are.
Well, how you feel, what you think.
Yes.
What you think about us.
And you guys, you know, engage with us on our social media. When we ask you questions, please answer, even if it's just,
you guys suck.
Yeah, no, be nice, you know, even if it's just little emojis.
Yeah.
But yeah, we want to know what your body image issues are and how you deal with them. And yeah.
And email us questions or thoughts to thoseafricanchicks@gmail.com.
Yeah, and if there are any topics that you think that we need to cover,
yeah,
let us know. If you want to come to the show, you have to let us know. We want you.
We want you,
that regular chick that has something important to say.
Yeah. And follow us on Twitter @thoseafricanchicks. Oh, @africanchicks.
Yeah, cool. I don't. Chesire manages the Twitter, so.
Yes, I do.
I don't know anything about Twitter.
But okay, yeah. Peoples, that's those African chicks talking about stuff that matters.
Yes, rock your body.
Mm, boom.
Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Today is a day of programming by, for, and about women. My name is Olivia Canlis, and I'm a collective member of the bi-weekly radio hour here on WBAI-FM, Asia Pacific Forum. The International Women's Day March in Los Angeles was thousands strong this past Sunday, and it was organized and led by Affirm LA. As with previous years, one stop was a detention center where organizers, speakers, and marchers sang and chanted outside, and were met by the clanging and knocks by those held inside the detention center. This is a collage of intersectional feminist women of color voices, including Affirm former chair, Jolene Levid. Special thanks to Hazel for the audio.
Deportation! Not one more! Deportation! Not one more!
Women's organization! We have 10 chapters nationwide, and we work for immigrant women's rights, we work against trafficking, and we work to dismantle militarism in all its forms, including the police occupation of our communities of color. And we are here. Affirm convened this rally today with our sisters and allies in over 80 organizations. Everybody take a look around. This is the result of women of color organizing. We want to specifically welcome the caravans from the Bay Area, Central Coast, High Desert, Inland Empire, South Bay, Orange County, and San Diego. Welcome to Los Angeles. Affirm organized this action today alongside our endorsers because we believe
us and Asian Americans have reported being verbally and physically attacked by racists, and Trump said that he would try to ban Muslims from this country. We are here because Trump's administration plans on deporting thousands and thousands of women, separating an estimated 1.4 million children from their parents. Just like Guadalupe Garcia de Rayos of Phoenix, Arizona, who had been in the United States since she was 14 years old and is the mother of two United States citizen children. Because people like Daniela Vargas, who was a DACA recipient and was picked up by ICE just this past Wednesday, she immediately got picked up after she spoke at an immigrant rights rally. She's been here since she was 7 years old, and now they're saying she may not even get a trial.
What?
We're here because that pig Trump has vowed to take away women's rights to unions, to comprehensive reproductive health care, and to ban women from 7 different countries. My sisters, we organized this rally because at least 7 trans women have been murdered this year alone. Yara Mitchell Elby, China Doll Dupree, Misha Caldwell, Jamie Lee Wounded Arrow, JoJo Stryker, Jaquarius Holland, Kiki Collier, all the victims of murder this year alone are trans women of color. We're going to take a moment of silence for our trans sisters that have been taken from us this year. We are not here just to stand against Trump and his cronies. No, we women of color have survived dictatorships, administrations that have sterilized, tortured, colonized, and raped us. We know that we have to resist no matter who sits in that White House. We pose a threat to those people in power because we are uniting from a position of strength. We are not solely here based on our shared oppression. My sisters, we are here together based on our shared resistance. Corporate allies want to wage war on our bodies, but today, for International Women's Day, we are here to scream out our own war cry! We are here to tell those racist, capitalist, sexist, ableist, homophobic pigs that despite centuries of subjugation, despite them starving us, beating us, pimping and raping us, taking away our healthcare, cutting our public education, busting our unions, denying us reproductive justice, and killing our children. They have never, ever, and will never, ever break the revolutionary spirit of women's resistance!
Yes, yes, do not forget the tongue of people, and we are still here. They try to erase us by making us not to let it speak our language or to dress in our regalia or do our ceremonies or pray in the way that we have done in our songs. But we have found that. It has not died. They try to bury it all like a mistake on a paper eraser. We are still here.
Both my parents were activists. I'm a movement kid. This piece is called I Cut My Teeth on Marx. I cut my teeth on Marx, Engels, Mao's Little Red Book. And I came up with the roots of Chicana feminism. Always within my little arm's reach or within earshot were books and writings, meeting minutes, political discussions, ideological arguments, and coded phone calls. My 4-year-old's vocabulary included words such as proletariat, petty bourgeoisie, self-determination, armed struggle, Black Panther, Brown Beret, White Liberal, Picket Line, Scab, Pig, Narc, walk out, sit in, locked up, and strung out.
Next is a roundtable of voices from international women strike organizers in Chiang Mai, Thailand. We discuss the specific struggles of women in Thailand and what it means to be a feminist in Thailand. First, we hear them share their names.
Okay. And I'm Liz Hilton. Who are you?
My name is B. Mun Chan.
My can do.
Your name?
Julia.
Julia Crack. A group of, excuse me, who we got around the table? We got sex workers, landers, farmers, women human rights defenders. Okay. Kayakalua, Ben Naksatri. Ti Patetai, Ben Yalai. What does it mean to be feminist in Thailand?
It means we have to work with the other women who sharing our same concern. For example, the community I'm with and together are fighting for their land, like right to collective land for the landless women farmer. So it's been every day, my day will be meeting with a lot of the other landless women. We come together to join the men into negotiation with the government office. We have to deal with security of our kids, how they go to the school. The community we are working in or living in used to be occupied by the illegal palm oil company. So we're fighting with them by pushing the authority to suing them to take the land back because it belongs to the government. And then our community got attacked a lot, so it's been killed. So then the children cannot live in the community. Mothers in the community have to think about how do they send the kid and where the kid can live safely. So that's what it means for grassroots women feminists. It means every day you're working with the other women to see how we make our life secure, including the children as well.
And while we're saying all that, no? The sex workers here are saying that being a feminist in Thailand and a sex worker means that we have to work very hard to have the feminist women accept us as women and to recognize our strengths and to acknowledge our part in the movement. They said that we are kicked to the back of the line. We do live under military government at the moment, and that is impacting on all women and men and children in Thailand, but women and mothers are especially suffering under the military government.
One of the things happening every day, even under dictator, even more under the dictator, is the women are not silent. Every day, even the landless women or the poor women in the community, which is outside from capital city, is demanding and then working every day to make sure that their issue will be addressed. First of all, it's among the community ourselves. We keep exchanging the problem with the other community. We keep looking at what opportunities to be able to express those concerns to the social network, but also to the social protection network of the people themselves. And I think it's also receiving a lot of good response from a lot of the young people who are also interested to look at the issue of the poor. I think the solution is you have to respond to the situation, and when you respond to the situation, you're looking more who else affected. So the form of the poor people network is actually happening every day. A lot of community doing exchange between themselves. They're looking for the solution. If one community faced under the forced eviction, what the other community can do for them. So then do we need a lawyer? Do we need the justice fund? Do we need everything? So that it seems like a daily response or the short term, but this will be bring into the strong network of the people who are affected from those policies.
We're very good at daily acts of resistance, and we're very good at creative daily acts of resistance because we've never been in power that we can resist directly.
Yeah.
And I think that the Thai women and other people in Thailand, but Thai women in Thailand now, are seeing, especially under this regime, that it's time to really join hands together. We can't just be single issue anymore. We have to go together. And, of course, it's all been in a very imperfect beginning for all of us, no? But we're moving together, and today we released a statement from the Declaration of the Global Network of Sex Workers. So that's sex workers from 77 countries around the world who are saying why they strike and why they are part of this movement. Because I think if they're talking about sex work, if they're talking about feminism for the 99%, it's very clear that sex workers have been part of the 99% since the beginning of time. I think we, some of the women are asking, do we have feminists in Thailand, really? There's been a very big disconnect sometimes between women who are with the academia and the professional women and grassroots women. So it's difficult. Be you, Miela, no?
Yeah. I think the so-called feminists, middle class or upper class, who saying about women's rights in the meeting room is not dangerous. Because what they have is just a paper and a microphone to speak with the policymaker, who will say everything yes, 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 because they know these women doesn't have anyone back them up. But the real women who are in danger is the women who are fighting for the real issue, like natural resources, the women who fight for the land. That's the real women in the front line. And they never been recognized as the women in the front line, the women feminists. And that is dangerous. A lot of women rights, land rights defenders have been killed in Thailand. Not the same as the men, good, but it's about recognition about who is there and who should be on the table, who actually negotiating with the government. So I think it's a lot of politics on what is feminist, what is not feminist, and who representing who. Which is actually a lot of women from the grassroots are defending their rights, and they're very strong, they're very clear about protecting the other women who so-called marginalized. But then when you're a majority, you're not marginalized, actually. You are a majority. You're just not being recognized by the media or with the people.
Yeah, we don't know who drew the margin.
Yeah, exactly.
For the last 16 years, there's been at least 200 of us gather here together on March the 8th. In resistance to many issues. The thing that's different this year is that we're feeling more connected to women around the world, because International Women's Day in many countries over the last years have become a celebration, and there hasn't been a lot to celebrate for women in Thailand, no? And when we're saying women in Thailand, it's migrant women, refugee women, and Thai women, indigenous women, no? There hasn't been a lot to celebrate.
No.
And so this year we feel really strengthened and inspired that women in many countries are going to actually stand up in resistance and say that we're fed up and we've had enough, which is what we have kind of been doing here for the last 16 years. I don't know whether you've looked at all, Olivia, but there's a map of the world events. Mm-hmm. And on Asia, there's like three. There's South Korea, one of the stands, and Thailand. Africa, there's no spots yet on Africa at all. And this is because the women of Asia and the women of Africa are so far ahead of us. We're going to have to run to catch them. They're right off the map. Their resistance every day and their unified resistance is so strong. And it's clear that we haven't got that link together. We've lost each other somewhere, because I can't believe the women resisting in Africa are not on the map for us. It feels very lonely here.
So what do you think it would take for there to be more global unity?
I think it's happening. I think we're already moving. I think there has to be a recognition from women in countries who have been part of the colonization and part of the imperialism to understand that and sit down and do a lot of listening. At the moment, our government is buying three submarines from China, and we, at the same time, people are hungry. We would suggest that they invest in mothers, invest in women, and invest in caring, and give up on some of their submarines and helicopters and other weapons of war.
Freedom, I don't need them. Where's your freedom? This one needs a brand new freedom. Weed and the key. We're in the kingdom to life. Let's beat them. We them smartphones don't beat them.
International Women's Day, or International Working Women's Day, has its roots in the socialist call to action and militant labor movement. New York City has its own history of militant labor movement struggle with a 1908 garment worker strike against poor working conditions. U.S.-based Women's Strike National Committee members from the West and East Coasts, Ivy Kitro and Susanna Daly, share insightful perspective about the effectiveness of a strike, what it means to build a militant anti-imperialist, anti-racist feminist movement in the United States, and its global implications, and provide a counter to the liberal media discourse that striking is a privilege. Suzanne Adeli is a global labor organizer, human rights attorney, and Arab community organizer engaged in supporting anti-imperialist movements, a member of the U.S.-Palestine Community Network and National Lawyers Guild International. Ivy Kitro is a Filipina-American social worker and works as a labor organizer in Los Angeles. She is the national chairperson of AFFIRM, a transnational feminist anti-imperialist organization dedicated to grassroots organizing against oppression in all of its forms.
We think that a strike is an effective tool, primarily because we live in this advanced capitalist society, right? Where we now see corporatist fascists that are being elected into our government. And so we believe what better way to attack than by attacking their wallets, right?
Organizing under a platform in which we are making the connection between violence against women and capitalism and violence against women and imperialism and economic violence against women, whether they're immigrants or unemployed, or whether they're migrants here or migrants abroad. I think that it's very powerful to come together and say that we're going to stand for women in a way that is going to challenge and confront the root causes of their oppression. Strike is a perfect action to make that point, particularly if we're able to build it in a place like the United States, which is the center of capitalist finance that is then spread throughout the world and helps to facilitate these systems, and also a center for destructive foreign policy that causes both structural and state violence here and throughout the world.
So part of the international women's strike platform is building a militant anti-imperialist, anti-racist feminist movement. Can you talk about what that means?
I've been thinking about that a lot as I've been helping to mobilize for this strike. And last week, we had an event that was organized by students at the New School in New York, in which a few hundred people came together to sort of like gear up for the coming strike. And it didn't just include students. It was attended by many people throughout the city. And I remember speaking there and recalled that that was the week that Berta Caceres, the Honduran indigenous environmental human rights activist, was assassinated in her home 1 year ago by a security force that is supported and protected by corporations that are supported and protected by a government that Hillary Clinton helped to install in Honduras in 2009 during a coup, which she fully supported. And I wanted people to remember who Berta was and to understand that any type of feminism that could tolerate these actions by politicians and by war criminals like Hillary Clinton is a complete contradiction of what feminism should be and is not something that protects women like Berta Caceres. And realizing that and realizing that, you know, there is a dominant kind of feminism, I think, that a lot of us have faced, that sometimes tends to put forth a liberal, often white, bourgeois, and analysis of what feminism is. And such a type of feminism helps, I think, to sort of reinforce the systems of oppression that so many women here and around the world are so impacted by.
You know, in addition to including the struggles of women across borders in our analysis as women who reside in the United States, I think that to practice transnational feminism is to practice moving beyond just looking at our similarities, but also confronting the differences that, you know, we may have in terms of perhaps our ideology or our practice, but still being connected through our united resistance. And so I think that also part of building a militant feminist movement here within the United States that's anti-imperialist and anti-racist also means that it's demonstrating not just against Trump, right? Because we've been having to resist since we've had to. And so we believe that, you know, through the strike, we're not just sending a message to Trump and his fascist regime, but we're also raising consciousness and encouraging people to demonstrate against the systems that allow Trump to rise. Like, our government structure here in the United States was built off of the slaughter of Native Americans and off of the enslavement and rape of, you know, Africans that were brought over here. And so this system was never set up for us. Therefore, our freedom will never be tied to the ballot box because it's fundamentally built against us. And so, you know, while we are striking within this system that exists today, we are also telling folks that we have the ability to build a new system.
I've talked to organizers for the International Women's Strike from Thailand and Poland. And one of the things that they underscored was the responsibility that the United States holds as an imperial power to shift the global paradigm, even for grassroots movements, and how we understand feminism and the women's struggle in other parts of the world. So the question that I have is, how do you take this responsibility?
You know, it's not even just a question of being focused or sort of being overwhelmed with just what's happening in our own countries as opposed to other countries, but it's also sometimes we're very caught up in what's happening just to our own communities within the United States. And you know, I've seen, I think, some incredible examples of how feminists of different backgrounds in the U.S. have come together to build, including this mobilization in itself, to build a militant, anti-racist, anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist feminism. And I think that that has to continue to happen, and we need to be able to build in some ways a common language and a common analysis of what our, you know, specific experiences are and what our vision is for continuing to be militant feminists, and what is it that we're trying to achieve. And I think we need to do that here in the U.S., and we also need to do that in connection with feminist movements abroad. And I think that the three of us in our own ways probably do that maybe more often than the average feminist in the U.S., just from the nature of our organizing of our organizing work and in our jobs, etc. And the question is then, you know, when we do have a global and internationalist analysis, and what do we do with that? What does that mean for how we continue to organize in the U.S.? And also, you know, within this feminism of the 99%, I mean, for me, there still is this bigger question. From what I've seen, you know, there was this sort of this consistent message for, you know, consistent message from these women abroad asking women in the United States to please be conscious of, you know, what U.S. policies are abroad and how it's affecting them or impacting them, whether that's through economic policies or war, etc. And if somebody were to ask sort of my opinion on whether or not I feel like that, that message has come through, I would say that generally I don't think that it has, but I think that this mobilization has helped it come through in a stronger way. And what I mean by that is that, you know, I just feel that outside of the United States, there is an enormous sense that this government is very much involved in the systems of oppression that exist around the world. And whereas it's very common for organizers or activists in this country, no matter, you know, the ideology or no matter what they're working on, to sometimes not consider that enough.
One thing that's been really beautiful is how we have all been able to come together despite our different, you know, ideological, political lines, and despite our different stances on different issues, and come together and mobilize already a successful demonstration just based on the conversations that are already being had, and seeing all the different, you know, schools, for example, closed down. And to be frank, I was a little worried because there's so many different people from different backgrounds, from different organizations, people whom we in Affirm have not worked with before. Mm-hmm. But it's been really amazing to see how we've all been able to come to the table with the same understanding and the same level of respect, and, you know, giving each other the space to, you know, share freely what we're thinking and what concerns we may have and how collectively we're willing to address them. And so, you know, after the strike, it'll really show us, particularly through the strike calculator that we are pushing on the ground, which is basically a tool for women to log in the hours that they went on strike so that we can come up with data in order to show the effectiveness of the strike, but also our impact on disrupting the flow of capital here in the United States on our economy.
How do you respond to the critique that the strike is for women with privilege?
We're really, you know, one, shifting the conversation around what is women's labor, whether it be paid, unpaid, in the formal or informal economy, visible or invisible. I think that people are now seeing how a strike can look in a non-traditional sense. And I mean non-traditional meaning this isn't one workplace where the workers at the workplace are going on strike for certain working conditions or wages or benefits, right? But this is a strike that is not only including people, you know, taking the day off, but really also women stopping their domestic labor, their labor in terms of caring for their families or communities. We have been able to meet people where they're at in terms of offering different ways for people to participate in the strike. So not only taking time off from work, but here in Los Angeles, we're also encouraging folks to take unity breaks where they take a break at the same time and they take a photo together holding a sign that they support the strike. Or if they're unable to take a break at the same time, doing a one-minute stand-up where they literally stand up where they're working and either begin chanting or hold up signs. We're also encouraging people to wear red in solidarity. And again, you know, by offering these different ways to participate, we're acknowledging that different people are in different vulnerable positions, right? Like some of our members in the firm are undocumented. Some of them are one paycheck away from homelessness. So we are being very intentional and mindful in trying to understand people's positionalities and where they're at in terms of the risks that they're willing to take at this moment. Obviously, our goal is to, you know, be able to, like, push folks in a way where, you know, we're getting people to be able to be more bold in what they're willing to do. And again, I think this strike will be a measurement of that and will really, you know, allow us to see how far we can go because freedom is just that important to us.
Yeah, I really agree fully with Ivy's response to that question. And I would also add that I think that there's a concerted effort in these media pieces to make these accusations about the privilege of the organizers and participants in this mobilization. And I think it's because people feel a little bit threatened by the politics of the Women's Strike US, which is clearly talking about you know, principles of economic justice and racial justice that are not always in ways that are not always acceptable in mainstream or liberal spaces. And I think that it has been garnering, I think as Ivy was saying, it has been garnering this, it's been building this dialogue, this discussion that's been happening in the media and outside the media about, you know, well, what is this, what do you mean by a strike? Who strikes in the U.S., right? We don't strike in the U.S. is people's immediate response to that. And I know there was a strike that was called for February 17th that ended up being, you know, visible but small. There was also a strong Day Without an Immigrant action that took place, which was also visible and strong. But the language of a strike is, you know, implying that, you know, no matter what we're doing, you know, we're trying to sort of disrupt, as you were saying before, you know, the flow of capitalism or the flow of the system. And, you know, it's exciting to see people, you know, either online or in the community, you know, really thinking deeply and seriously, well, what does it mean for us to go on strike? You know, what is our right to do that? And then also, you know, broadening their minds to think, well, if we can do this much now, then, you know, what could we do in the future, you know, to impact, you know, the systems of oppression? And I think that those discussions and that discourse is, frankly, you know, scaring, you know, the mainstream culture and the liberal culture and, you know, their response is to sort of make these concerted arguments that that this is sort of being created out of privilege